Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Lorraine Chisholm.
During the September 17th appearance on the David Letterman Show, the CBS News anchor Dan Rather laid it on the line. George Bush is the president, Rather said. He makes the decisions. Speaking as one American, the newsman added, wherever he wants me to line up, just tell me where, and he'll make the call. George W. Bush, meanwhile, dredges up the image of old cowboy movies calling for Osama bin Laden dead or alive, referring to a crusade, speaking of the terrorist crime as an act of war, and restricting the definition of the ways the world can respond, either with him or with the terrorists. To look at the rhetoric being employed, the media response to the events of September 11th, and how the public is responding, we've reached Robert Jensen in Austin, Texas. Robert Jensen is a ZNET columnist, and he teaches journalism at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also a member of the No War Collective. Good morning, Bob.
Hi, glad to be here.
I guess if we're going to talk about the rhetoric of the U.S. response to the terror attacks, a logical place to start is with the code word that's now been dropped, infinite justice. What could we read into that particular formulation?
Well, this has been a week of really chilling words being used by the Bush administration. Infinite justice didn't have anything to do with, I think, spreading justice infinitely around the planet. It had to do with the justice of the sword, which is about victory, not peace. And it's a sword that I think the Bush administration intends to keep unsheathed for a long time. They dropped it because of the sensitivities they were afraid of with the Muslim world, but they can drop it, but it's been clear in all sorts of other statements and actions they have made and taken that this is, in fact, what they're planning. And, I mean, if we just look at Bush's speech Thursday night, some of the, you know, some of the language, it's not just the language they're using, but what's clearly underneath it that I think we as a people now have to be scared, and scared not of terrorists coming after us. That's always, of course, something people worry about, but I think it's now time to be scared of our own government.
Mm. As you mentioned, U.S. leaders are putting out the message that this is a war, that it's a war on terrorism, that it's different than any war that's been fought, and they're talking as if this is going to be some new combination of military engagement and intelligence operations and political pressure. What should we be reading between the lines here?
Well, I think, you know, we need to look at history. History doesn't tell us everything, but it does help us. Let's remember when the Cold War started. We were told this is a new kind of war, right? Not just a shooting war. It's going to require us to marshal all our resources. It's going to require a commitment on the part of the people. And in the late 1940s and 1950s, the United States government used that fear. It wasn't really about, you know, the Soviet Union threatening us around the world. It was about using that fear to militarize this society, to institutionalize a permanent, you know, large-scale military budget, and to justify foreign interventions around the world that had nothing to do, for the most part, with the fear of the Soviet Union. They had to do with thwarting the legitimate aspirations of independent movements, mainly in the Third World. All right, that's what happened in the 1940s and 50s, right? The same kind of call to the public for a new kind of war, and the same understanding that you're either with us or against us, right? Because that's what that period was about. You're either a good American who backs your government, or you're a communist, you're a traitor, you're dangerous. And I am so afraid of a replication of that. I can see it everywhere. I don't want to be sort of hyperbolic and kind of go over the top, but it's impossible not to see these combinations or these parallels. And I think the American people, again, have to be afraid not just of external threats, but now of this growing madness. And that's what I'm calling it, straight out. This is madness, in my opinion. And we have to stop it. That's the task. We can learn from history, and we can understand we have to stop it now, not 10 years down the road.
I just want to spend a little more time on what you meant. One of the things that you mentioned from Bush's speech already on Thursday night, I guess one of the most dramatic things that he said is that you're either with us, mm-hmm, or you're with the terrorists. What do you make of that statement, of his formulation there?
Well, that's a not so subtle command to the rest of the world that they better line up, because we know that if you're with the terrorists, what that means. That means you will be destroyed. That was, again, let's go back and talk about history. The Gulf War, 1991, Iraq had invaded Kuwait. There was a violation of international law. The image of the Gulf War is very fresh in the minds of the Third World, we must remember. And they understand what this means. This means you either line up with us or you line up against the wall and face destruction. And that is not the way, you know, a decent civilized society goes forward.
What do you make of Bush's explanation in his speech for the hatred towards the U.S. that the terror attacks of last week indicate?
Well, this is, I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous. He says they hate us because they hate our freedom. That's ridiculous. First of all, they, who is they? You know, the rest of the world is not a monolith, okay? If he means simply the terrorists hate us because they hate our freedom, that's obviously not true. Osama bin Laden, other radical Islamic fundamentalist groups have made it very clear what they object to. They object to the presence of U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia on holy land. They object to U.S. support for Israel and the oppression of the Palestinians. They object to the ongoing economic sanctions that have strangled the Iraqi civilian population and killed as many as a million people since the end of the Gulf War. They object to the U.S. putting forth in the Middle East its power to secure U.S. interests. Now, that's not to say, and it's very important to make this clear because people in the general public are quick to come back and say, oh, well, you're supporting the terrorists. You think they're justified. Of course, there's nothing to justify what happened on September 11th. Anybody who tries to is already, in my opinion, outside of a kind of humanity, okay? They have lost some part of their own soul, and I don't mean to be so theological, but it's really at that level. It's not to justify, it's to understand. We have to separate justification from explanation. We don't endorse what was happening, what happened, but we have to understand it if we're going to stop it, because we're not going to stop it by repeating the actions that have led us to this point, right? If the people of the Middle East, and not just Osama bin Laden, but the people of the Middle East generally, the Arab and Muslim worlds, are angry at the United States for its policies, which have killed so many innocent people, is it going to help our position to kill more innocent people in the Middle East? Or will that only deepen the resentment and anger and produce another generation of terrorists? I mean, it's in our own self-interest to be sensible about this, I think.
Robert, how would you characterize the coverage of the crisis in the American media?
Well, this is a really, in some sense, I'm very conflicted because as a former journalist who knows how difficult it is to put together breaking news, I have a lot of admiration for the work these guys are doing, right? They're really putting in the effort. But as someone concerned about, you know, peace, I have to say I have never been so disappointed in the mainstream corporate media in this country. From the beginning, and literally from, you know, the middle of the day on September 11th, the Bush administration had already made a decision to pursue a violent military response as the only option to this crisis. Right? It was clear that diplomacy, treating it like an issue of a crime of mass murder, and trying to involve the international legal community in it, had already been pushed aside. This was war. I remember, I wrote down in my notes, the first time I heard Peter Jennings say, massive military retaliation. It was very early in the day. And the American news media has not broken ranks with that yet. They are still pursuing this story as if the military option is the only reasonable option. They are excluding voices, and I don't think, you know, they get up in the morning and decide to do this consciously, but they are excluding the voices, for the most part, that are saying something different. Although it's interesting to see that even some very mainstream people are starting to say some of these things. I just read some comments from General Zinni, Anthony Zinni, a former U.S. general, who is challenging the framing of this as a military operation. And as those voices, in, you know, those quote-unquote credible voices become more, we may see this change in the media, but for the first 10 days of this crisis, the U.S. media has failed abysmally its responsibility in a democracy to both put forward the information we need and the widest diversity of voices and analysis we need so that we as a people can come to terms with what's happened.
In one of Canada's national newspaper, a columnist named Marcus Guy wrote against exploring, he had this in quotation marks, root causes of the terrorist attacks, as if this was some sort of discredited theory of terrorism rather than a critical stance of asking profound questions about the situation. To what extent has the context of bin Laden's particular grievances and more general anti-Americanism in the Middle East been explored in the U.S. media in the past week and a half?
Well, it has been at certain places. I must say that, you know, the media is not a monolith. You know, this is not a complete exclusion. exclusion. For instance, very early in this, within the first two or three days, I saw an ABC News program in which voices from the Middle East, journalists, and most prominently Hanna Ashrawi, the spokesperson for the Arab League and formerly a very prominent Palestinian politician, were allowed to say some of the things we've just talked about and say them uninterrupted. Peter Jennings did not cut in. He let her talk. And that's crucial that that happened. But the problem is, and the point we have to make is, 5 minutes stuck in the middle of a 24-hour news day does not disrupt the basic frame. In other words, if the frame established is military response is necessary, right, then you can, a few voices here and there doesn't disrupt the frame. That's what people, I think, need to think sort of at, in terms of patterns of coverage. So when journalists say, well, we gave Hanna Ashrawi 5 minutes, yes, but you gave the generals and the former intelligence officials and the terrorism experts, you know, you gave them 23 hours to make their points. And it's not surprising that those other voices get drowned out. But, you know, there has been some coverage of that, but the problem is, and the columnist you're talking about is an example of that, is if you try and expand or explain root causes or even explore them, there's an immediate assumption that somehow you are not American, that you are on the side of the terrorists. I have been attacked personally here for writing something that tried to do that. I was publicly condemned by the president of my university for having the gall to talk openly in public about the history of United States foreign policy. Well, that has a real chilling effect, and we have to resist that, right? I mean, take a domestic example. You know, for a long time, people have talked about or tried to talk about the root causes of crime, which are clearly rooted in economic situations and poverty. But the United States decided in the 1980s, because politicians pushed this, that we didn't care about root causes. We were going to deal with it by putting people in jail. We have 2 million people in jail in this country now. Has that solved the problem of crime? Has it helped us come to terms with the problem of poverty? No. You have to deal with root causes. It's insane to think that you can go forward and solve a problem in the world without dealing with root causes. I understand the emotion of it, but intellectually, it's a ridiculous position.
Bob, days after the attack, the media was characterizing the public as calling for revenge, and certainly there has been a huge patriotic fervor that's been whipped up. Do you think that there is any space in the public mood to have a range of responses to what's happened on September 11th?
Well, I think the politicians desperately want to make sure that doesn't happen, and I think the media, at least at this point, are not doing much to make that space. And that means what it always means for the history of popular movements. We have to make that space ourselves. We have to become our own media. We have to use the web for those of us who have access. We have to, you know, people are printing up sort of zines, you know, with flyers, handouts, information. We have to create the space. I mean, it's not going to happen if we don't. The first day of the crisis on Tuesday, it was quite clear to us by the end of the day here in Austin, there were a lot of people who had instincts toward peaceful, not violent solutions. And they were telling us they didn't have any place to talk. They were afraid to speak up at work. So Wednesday morning, we called a public meeting. We put it out over our email list that the Nowhere Collective operates. But we only had 8 hours notice, basically. And we thought maybe 40, 50 people will come to this meeting. We booked a room that held 170, figuring it would be half empty. There were 250 people there that night on short notice. There were people who came over at 10:30 as I was leaving, saying, I just read my email, I just heard about it, are you still there? Desperate to talk. The people want that space, I think. We all want it, and we have to create it, because the powers that be are not going to give it to us.
You've said in a statement by the No War Collective that the time to mourn has been stolen from us. What do you mean by that statement?
Well, as we've been trying to, I mean, I remember sitting in my office with members of the collective, and we were talking, and you know, we're human beings, right? We were grieving. I mean, no decent person could watch those towers fall and not have some part of them die inside. And we were in that mode, and we were all, you know, just trying to cope. And then the war talk came on the television, and we turned to each other and we said, we can't wait. If we wait, we are lost. We don't start trying to build a movement to object to this. We will lose, because they're going to move quickly. It's clear they're moving quickly. And we wrote that the Bush administration took away our time to grieve, because while we are still all trying
I mean, I think what you voiced there is something that a lot of people who are peace activists and social activists are feeling. I mean, it's some very, very profound statements that you made, and I thank you for it. Now, the crisis, as you mentioned, threatens to have a chilling effect on anti-globalization organizing. Environmental groups in the States are backing off their criticism of Bush on oil development and the Kyoto Protocol. And even some peace activists are talking about giving the situation time. Now, you seem to be saying something different from that. Where do you think activists need to put their energy in the coming weeks and months?
Well, you know, one of the things, we always have to look for hope out of crisis and tragedy. And one of the things that I hope can happen is that the American public, but specifically the progressive activist community, can see the wake-up call that we have just been given, right? These issues are all connected, and everybody, no matter what your basic sort of interest is, I think has to come together to understand. Apparently, I haven't had the chance to actually read it yet, but the Sierra Club has said we need to back off on this, okay? Well, what are the environmental consequences if the United States goes in with tactical nuclear weapons into Afghanistan? Is that not an environmental issue? The thing we have to realize now, and we have such a moment of clarity where we can do this, is the common core of all these movements is a challenge to illegitimate power, the concentration of power in too few hands. If the Bush administration gets away with going to war, it will not be because the entire American public wants it. That's what they're going to tell us, but that's not the case. We know already from the expressions of anti-war feeling that these polls are very, very thin. I don't think these 84% want war polls really are getting at what Americans are thinking. If they do this, it is not in our name. It's because they have concentrated power in such a few number of hands. That's the common link between feminist organizing, which I have done, you know, most of my adult life now, environmental work, anti-war work, anti-corporate work, the globalization movement. All of us have the same basic analysis, I think, at some level. And we have to come together and say, this is a moment to reach people, right, to talk about these links between all of these issues, right? It's an incredible, I mean, I hate to say this because in a tragedy like this, none of us want to talk like this, but it's a moment to move people. Right, people's emotions have been touched in a way they've never been touched before, and it's incredibly important, not just for the traditional anti-war groups, who also, by the way, I don't think have been stepping up to the plate in the way they should, but it's important for all of them to come together and say, we need to take a chance. Yes, we may lose members. Maybe the Sierra Club membership will drop by 5% if they take a stand. Well, that's the time when we find out what people's commitments are, and we need to push that, not back off from it.
Bob, thank you very much this morning. Thank you for your voice, and thank you for your courageous efforts.
Well, thanks for having us on, and you all keep up the good work you're doing.
Thanks. I've been speaking with Robert Jensen. Bob is a ZNET columnist, and he teaches journalism at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also a member of the No War Collective.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada.